Good morning. My wife's a dietitian, and one of the jokes that she sometimes has heard is that a dietitian was asked one time by a client, "What do you think is the most dangerous food that a person could possibly eat?" And this particular dietitian had recently gone through a very acrimonious divorce, and she thought for a minute, and she says, "Wedding cake." It's too bad that some people find that their great expectations that they have of marriage are soon dashed, and that dreams sometimes can literally turn into nightmares and deep disappointment. Too many are like what some have said of Hollywood, a place where they marry for better, for worse, but never for long. And that's really true. You know, the average marriage in the United States today only lasts about 8 years. People make a much bigger commitment when they sign a 30-year mortgage today than when they stand before the altar, and oftentimes it's not until death do us part, but until divorce do us part. Very sad when you think about the divorce rate today. And it's particularly tragic when you read that about 30% of marriages fail within the first 2 years. I mean, they bail and give up on it within 24 months, hardly give marriage a chance. Even though we talk a lot about the divorce rate today, and it's certainly much higher than it should be or that we want it to be, I'm just as concerned as a marriage and family counselor and evangelist at what counselors refer to as the marriage failure rate. And that is couples who choose to stay together. They have no plans on getting divorced, but they stay together somewhat unhappily. Do you know that only in 17% of marriages in the United States that where people have been married 20 years or longer, do both parties report that their marriage is highly satisfactory? Only 17%. Wow. That is really sad. But to me, what is most tragic is that the statistics about marital happiness and divorce are only slightly better for members of the church than the world. And in that regard, the world has stepped into the church in a very tragic way. Sometimes when I encourage people to get premarital counseling or to take classes on marriage to assist them both in their marriage and in their parenting, some people really resist that. Some say, "Well, I'll just kind of go with the flow and see what happens." If you go with the flow, the result is you will just have an average marriage. Is that really what you want? You know, I'm not interested in having an average marriage. I want to have an extraordinary, special marriage. And that's what I want for each of you. If you go with the flow, you may have a marriage that only lasts 8 years. Or maybe a marriage that does not go very well as far as really meeting your needs and expectations. The average marriage in America, over time, the couple grows apart, communication breaks down, and they do not meet each other's needs. And the theme for many people's marriages is that of the righteous brothers. He said, "You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. You've lost that loving feeling. And something very, very special is gone." If you're here today or you're listening online and maybe you're married, but you feel like you've lost that loving feeling, that you certainly have long, long forgotten the wonderful days of the honeymoon, I want you to know that there's hope out there. And I think it's high time that churches and Christians develop practical tools to help people have not just average marriages, but at least be in the top tier of those who find their marriages mutually highly satisfactory. Obviously, no marriage is perfect. A marriage is simply made up of two imperfect human beings who try to make the best of life together. But nonetheless, it was given by God in the Garden of Eden before sin even entered the world. Marriage is designed by God, and if we follow his principles, we should be able to find it mutually beneficial. And I believe that it's a very important witness to the world. If we're a Christian, what kind of marriage and family do we have? And when the glory of Jesus Christ is at stake, mediocrity is not an option. Amen? You know, when I was a young preacher in my early 20s, and people from the church and even the community would come to me and need help, I really was pretty clueless as far as, you know, how to really help folks. You know, it wasn't just as easy as reading certain passages and say, now, you need to go home and love your wife, and you need to be submissive to your husband, and everything will be great. You know, it's not quite that simple. So I went on a path to take what I found was a weakness in my ministry. I wanted to make it a strength. And I started doing a lot of research and studying and got some additional education and tried a lot of different things. And what I'm going to share with you today, as Eric mentioned, this whole day is going to be dedicated to a marriage that works, is what I have found works better than anything else out there in my judgment. And, of course, it's based upon biblical principles. So I want you to know also that when I did this at home recently in Kirkland, I called it a relationships that work, because these principles apply across the board to all of our interpersonal relationships. Now, today I'm going to be using all these illustrations about marriage, but if you happen to be a widow or a widower or someone who's single or divorced or whatever, this applies to all of our interpersonal relationships. So please don't tune me out and think, oh no, a whole day on marriage and that's not for me. This is for everybody. Another reason why this is for everybody is because we all know people that are married. And we all know people that have less than satisfactory marriages, or maybe marriages in crisis. And a lot of times, you, like me, I think, feel pretty clueless about how do I go about helping these folks practically. So I want you to think about these sessions also as ways, as your evangelist this weekend, I'm trying to equip the saints for service. And I don't think there's a better service we could do than to sit down and help people to understand how they can have better, more successful relationships in general, and marriages in particular. So, bottom line is this. This is the key. It's really very simple. Both parties must learn to care, that is, meet each other's needs to the best of their ability, and at the same time, strive to protect, avoid hurting or offending the other party in practical ways. We live in a brotherhood where marriage, divorce, and remarriage is a controversy that is constantly debated and is the focus of many people's thoughts and thinking. And I don't want to belittle the fact that folks have to figure out what the truth is on that important subject. But my suggestion to all of us is that instead of putting the focus on divorce and remarriage, how about if we put the focus on the marriage? The only thing that pleases the Lord when it comes to MDR is prevention. I mean, even if somebody gets this, quote, scriptural divorce, somebody still sinned. It's still a tragedy. So my focus, as much as possible, is how can we support and preserve and protect our marriages and families so that they thrive, not just survive. And so that we don't have so much divorce, which God hates, in our church families. So put on your thinking cap with me, and let's get started today. Now, I'm going to start by recommending two best-selling books, and you've probably heard about these. It's been around for decades. There's a book by Willard Harley called His Needs, Her Needs. It sold over 3 million copies. And this is focusing in on how to care for your spouse. There's some really great communication tools in this. We'll talk about this in the 5 o'clock session this evening, Lord willing. But there's another book that is not nearly as well known, not as popular, but it's just as essential, called Love Busters. And this focuses in on how to protect your marriage from habits that destroy romantic love. His Needs, Her Needs, the subtitle is How to Maintain an Affair-Proof Marriage. The idea is, if you're meeting your needs in marriage, you're not going to even be tempted to have an affair. You know, if you've got a Cadillac in the garage, you're not going to be tempted to run down to the neighbors and steal their used VW. I mean, that's kind of the idea. And so we want to figure out ways that we can care and protect for our relationships in a way that we literally meet each other's needs and find ourselves, as Harley says, irresistible as we grow in our love each day. Both of these books are available on Amazon. You can get used copies for just, you know, $5 to $10. Highly recommend that you consider buying these books, reading them, and keeping them in your library. You will find that they will help you to deflect the fiery darts of the evil one that Satan is directing against our marriages and families today. However, just as with Daniel 2, when it describes the Roman Empire, basically says it has legs of iron, but it has feet of clay. This, of course, is written by a man that is a very successful marriage and family therapist. And there are, I'm going to say right up front, some glaring weaknesses that we need to point out. But sadly, because of these weaknesses, I think some people have sort of thrown out Harley's paradigm about marriage. And I don't think that's necessary. But there are some problems with Harley's work. The first is, he really doesn't emphasize spiritual needs like he should. He mentions it, but just in passing. When asked about this, he simply said, I wrote these books for a broader audience, and he didn't want to turn off non-Christians or secular people. And so he doesn't focus on spiritual needs the way I do when I do marriage counseling. And secondly, he does not believe in or teach male servant leadership. He rejects that biblical pattern of the husband being the head of the house. And thirdly, he uses the scriptures a lot, but he doesn't cite them. In fact, when I read through these, I can see, oh, well, sometimes he quotes them word for word, but he doesn't mention them because, again, he doesn't want to turn off a secular audience. So these are weaknesses, and the reason why I passed out to you, or had passed out to you, these the handouts for today, these are my notes that I give a couple when they come to me. It's called Key Concepts Necessary to Make a Marriage Work, and these are a summary of Willard Harley's ideas, but I've enhanced them, and I have kind of done some additional things with them that I think makes this work biblical and extremely useful. So I want you to practice some really good self-discipline and not be tempted to be reading through this while I'm delivering the message. I'd appreciate it if you'd wait and kind of follow along with this at home. But you'll find this very helpful, a very helpful resource. And I've talked with Steve, and I believe you guys have posted this on your website. So if you're listening online, you can download this. And I think you'll find my edits and enhancements very useful in using this material, both either for yourself or in helping someone else. So I've divided this material into three parts. The first is the introduction, where we talk about the love bank and the key to passion. Very helpful insight. And then secondly, we're going to look at overcoming love busters, the habits that destroy marital love or make withdrawals from the love bank. That'll be our worship period. And then thirdly, we're going to look in our final evening service. I hope to have some time at the end again for some final question answers on just meeting each other's needs. And we're going to look specifically at some gender differences, because the most important emotional needs for a woman are usually different from that of a man. And that's where a lot of times you clash. So understanding those unique differences is just really important. So today in our Bible class period, I want to look at the love bank, which is the key to passion. I want to look at the romantic myth and how dangerous that is, and expose that for the lie that it is. I want to look at the importance of habits. And then I just want to introduce briefly the concept of love busters, which will get us ready for our sermon very shortly. Okay. Obviously, when we talk about love, you have to think about the love chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. You know, how do I keep it alive? Well, if you take white light and you put it through a prism, the result is this beautiful collage of colors that we refer to as the rainbow. And if you took love as if it were white light and you put it through the prism of the Holy Spirit, what we have is these eight beautiful principles, this collage of colors that tells us what love is really all about, true, authentic love. And I want you to notice that when the Bible describes true love, it doesn't talk about feelings. It doesn't. It talks about action. These are all verbs that tell us what to do. Ultimately, love is a decision. Love is how you treat somebody. And we're told that there's these eight aspects of how we can truly practice love in our lives. I'm sure you're familiar with this. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. Does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. And I love this last sentence. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Everybody wants to have a marriage that is filled with some degree of passion. And I think the Song of Solomon is given to us as a part of God's holy word that reminds us that a wise person, remember the Song of Solomon, though we don't talk about it very much, is a part of the wisdom literature. And a wise person will understand the value of and cultivate romantic love and passion in their marriage. And so I want to be wise and encourage people not to lose that loving feeling. But the feelings come after you choose, out of a sense of commitment and understanding, to treat each other in ways that will help them to be appreciated, help the man to feel respected, and help the woman to feel cherished, which is what every woman wants in a marriage. All right, so how do you practically apply this? That's really where the rubber meets the road. Well, enter the love bank. Harley discusses this a lot in his work, and he says that the love bank always ultimately explains why you're feeling the way you're feeling in your, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, in your marriage relationship, in your relationship with your kids. You know, this again works across all of our interpersonal relationships. And he gives this very fascinating analogy. He says, let's assume that you first meet someone, you haven't met them before, you don't have really strong feelings toward them, they're just pretty much a stranger. and then they become an acquaintance. But the more interactions you have with them, the more either love units that are made because you enjoy the encounter with them, or maybe you have some negative experiences with them. Maybe you feel like they were kind of rude or short with you, and then, you know, suddenly, you know, you don't feel so good about them. When you go to a bank, you open up a bank deposit. And that's what happens when you first meet someone and begin to, you know, establish the process of going from an acquaintance to hopefully a dear friend, or in a romantic relationship, someone that over time you, quote, fall in love with. And so positive exchanges, it's like putting money in the bank. It's like depositing love units. Negative exchanges, it's like writing checks. They are withdrawals. Every relationship at times are going to have some withdrawals. I mean, sometimes we sort of wake up on the wrong side of the bed, and maybe we're short with our spouse, or maybe we forget an important anniversary date or something, and you hurt the other party's feelings. People don't wake up and intentionally, maliciously want to harm their family members. I just don't believe that that happens. It's very rare. But it does occur that you do things that cause the other person to be somewhat upset with you or disappointed or frustrated. Those are withdrawals. Every relationship has some withdrawals along with deposits. But when the love bank balance is high, when you reach a certain threshold where you've been together and you look forward to being together in the future and you really can't think of the future without this person being in it, then all of a sudden, kind of the clouds clear and you feel like you're falling in love with this person. We all remember how wonderful that was and what that felt like to be on cloud nine. Psychologically, you're actually somewhat emotionally obsessed with this other person for a time. And there's just this natural instinct to want to please this person that has been pleasing you so much. And you feel close and emotional to this person, and you want to make it permanent. So eventually you propose to the lady, and the lady says yes, because, boy, her love bank is really filled, and she expects in marital bliss for this to continue on indefinitely. You guys with me here? Now, what we need to understand is, though romantic love is very powerful, it's also very fragile. And if the two of you are together and you're kind of fighting against a common foe, I mean, it can really strengthen that love. The worst thing, however, you can do is to take your spouse or your romantic love for granted. I mean, the husband is, you know, usually pretty good about courting his girlfriend and wooing her and kind of sweeping her off her feet in those early days of the courtship. And boy, the woman thinks this is great. But what happens sometimes is you stand at the altar and instead of saying, I do, you say to yourself, I'm done. I've got my wife. Now I can move on and climb the corporate ladder and focus on other things, whatever they might be. And just like a beautiful rose, it can only be healthy if it's tended to and watered very regularly. Same thing is true with romantic love. The worst thing you can do is just be distracted, focused on other things, and neglect it. It's like not watering the flowers. And it wilts very quickly. And so what often happens is you stop really going out of your way to do kind and loving things and follow 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and life happens, right? Children come, and boy, do they ever take a lot of your time and energy. And people get sick. I mean, we know how difficult at times life can be. And where's romance in all of that? So what often occurs is you're not making these big deposits anymore.
because you're not going out of your way to be really thoughtful. But you're still sort of writing checks. You're still going through life and getting frustrated with one another and feeling stressed. Now, what happens if you have a bank account and you continue to write checks on it all the time for your daily expenses, but you rarely make deposits? After a while, your bank account's empty, right? Eventually. That's what happens when people suddenly wake up and say, I don't have any feelings for you anymore. I don't love you anymore. And oftentimes when that happens, people panic. And they think, oh, it's over. And that's oftentimes when people come for counseling.
When the love bank is empty, you don't have the emotional feeling. And if you continue to not try to address the problem with the love bank and spending quality time together and speaking each other's love language and all that kind of stuff, then, but you continue to make withdrawals, you continue to sort of write checks, what happens when you do that at the bank? You know, checks bounce. You get notices from the bank. You get penalties. Well, what happens is you get overdrawn, and then instead of saying, I don't have any feelings for you anymore, suddenly you start being angry with one another, and you start feeling bitterness toward the other party, and things begin to go from bad to worse. And that's how a couple can stand at the altar, kind of be lost in each other's eyes, and just have such great expectations on their wedding day. Sometimes just a few years later, they're at the divorce court, filled with bitterness and animosity and acrimony toward each other. How does that possibly happen? Well, this paradigm of the love bank is what explains how that happens. And I want you to know, you will find this. You're married, you will find this a great communication tool. My wife and I use this all the time. You know, I'll say, now I know this isn't your preference, and I know you'd really rather than I not do this, but how many love units is this going to set me back? You know, marriage is give and take. You know, is there something I can do if I do this? You know, you'd rather I not, but if I do it, are we okay? Is there something I can do maybe to make up for this? You know, something that maybe is not my preference, but that you would really enjoy. Marriage is kind of a negotiation in many ways, right? And so, you know, if my wife says, listen, this is going to be a big withdrawal from the love bank. I want you to know that. On a scale of 1 to 10, how big? And if she says, that's way up there, you know what? My job is to keep that love bank full. It's just not worth it. Okay, I won't do it. But if she says, oh, you know, no big deal, maybe just a one or two. And I'll say, I think our love bank can handle that. She goes, yeah, so do I. But if I do that too often, then I'm in trouble, right? So I wake up literally almost every morning and I think, what can I do to make a deposit in my wife's love bank? Because if you can limit the withdrawals and make significant deposits on a regular basis, every year just gets better and better and better. You don't have to let your love grow stale. You don't have to lose that loving feeling. But you've got to make sure you give it proper attention. And that's where so many marriages fall down. So, let me talk to you also about the romantic myth. The romantic myth is sort of an invention of Hollywood. It's only really been around since maybe the 1920s. It's a prevalent thought in our culture. But it kind of seeps into our thinking, and we're not even aware that we bought into this lie. But it's a very terrible lie. And that is the idea that once you, quote, fall in love, that this is just so special. It's you and me, babe, against the world. And you think that maybe other people are going to have problems, but wow, they don't know what we've got. And so couples often fall in love, and they're kind of cavalier about this, and they think, man, we're going to be different. And we're going to never lose this, because it's just, we're just on this emotional high. Well, if they just think for a moment about a 50% divorce rate in this country, and other couples who stand at the altar and who marry for love, like we do here in the West, and I'll let you know that that's a myth. Yes, you can lose it. And a whole lot of people do. And so you need to not take this for granted. But people have this idea, once I find my soulmate, this one person that is meant for me, then, wow, everything's going to be wonderful. It's all rainbows and unicorns from here on out. That's just a lie. Even the best of marriages, you know what? They require a lot of work, a lot of effort. Things that are worthwhile don't come easily. And that's true with a really rich marriage. The other part of this romantic myth that I run across all the time, and I have such sympathy for people who believe this lie, and that is that once you lose it, this romantic love, once you wake up one day, the love bank is empty, and you say, I don't have feelings for you anymore, they feel trapped. Because they think that it can never be regained. It's over. First, they believe the lie that they can never lose it. But then once they lose it, they think, oh, that's proof that it wasn't what this was supposed to be. I must have married the wrong person. And, oh, no. And we need to have sympathy for folks who are trapped in an unhappy marriage. I mean, it's one thing to be walking along, you know, the seashore, holding hands while the sun sets. And it's another thing to suddenly feel like you're in handcuffs and you've made vows to a person that you can't stand. Or perhaps it's been a tremendous disappointment to you in so many years. I understand. I've had people come to me all the time and it's just like, I know I don't believe in divorce, but we're just so unhappy. Just kind of miserable in our relationship. And people say and do things when their love banks are empty that are so out of character for them that they told themselves they would never say or do. And what we need to do is to be people that give them hope. We need to help them to see that this is a lie, that romantic love and passion can be reborn. And I've seen people follow the principles we're going to be talking about this weekend and address the love bank, start avoiding withdrawals and starting to make deposits. And guess what? The passion returns with a vengeance. But I repeat, you have to stop doing things that offend your spouse. You have to stop making withdrawals. And you have to start making deposits. And when you do that, the feelings return. And in spite of all the negative stuff out there about marriage these days, there really is hope. Jesus said in Mark 10 and verse 27, all things are possible with God. Do you believe that? And secondly, we're told, very famous passage, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I think that's talking about a couple who really wants to put things back together again. And I mean, even though it seems sort of hopeless, you can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. Sometimes a couple will come to me, and I will only do biblical counseling. If they're not interested in that, I won't even take them on. And so they're Christians, right? And yet here they are just in this unhappy relationship. And sometimes they'll say, our love is dead. Not anything like it used to be.
And I'll say, well, I have good news for you. As Christians, you believe in and serve a God who specializes in the resurrection from the dead. Right?
I mean, the whole basis of our faith is we believe that Jesus' soul was quickened and made alive by the Holy Spirit, and he came forth from that tomb on that Sunday morning. And we believe that one of these days, the same thing's going to happen to our lifeless corpse, right? We're going to come forth from the tomb just as he did. Now, if you believe that, and that is the very basis for your faith, do you not understand that if you truly, humbly turn your marriage back over to God and submit to him and his principles, that he can take a dead love and make it come alive again? Come on, you need to have faith. And you need to believe when you prayed about marrying this person that when God answered your prayer, yes, that he knew what he was doing. And don't doubt the commitment. And don't forget your vows. And if you'll just let me be your coach and take you through this paradigm, you will be amazed at how your love can be reborn. Sometimes people leave my counseling office and it's just like they have hope in their eyes again. And many times people are glad they went through the crisis because they learned of some principles they needed and things get better than they have ever been. So don't believe the romantic myth that once you lose it, it's gone. All that is the devil's lie to convince people to bail on their vows and run off and have an affair with someone else because they think the grass is greener on the other side. Now there's two sides to marital conflict. Either couples fail to make each other happy. This is a failure to care, a failure to make deposits in each other's love banks. Not because they intentionally want to neglect their spouse. They just get busy with other things. Husbands typically with their careers. Wives sometimes they're too much mother and not enough wife. Meanwhile, it happens to good people. Or couples make each other unhappy. This is a failure to protect. Failure to stop withdrawals. And that's what I want to focus in on in our next two messages. But before we get into our Q&A, I just want you to listen to this, and I want you to ask the question, who am I? I am your constant companion. I am your greatest helper or heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I am completely at your command. Half the things you do, you might just as well turn them over to me, and I will be able to do them quickly and correctly. I am easily managed. You must merely be firm with me. Show me exactly how you want something done, and after a few lessons, I will do it automatically. I am the servant of all great individuals and, alas, of all failures as well. Those who are great, I have made great. Those who are failures, I have made failures. I am not a machine, though I work with all the precision of a machine plus the intelligence of a human. You may run me for a profit or run me for ruin. It makes no difference to me. Take me, train me, be firm with me, and I will place the world at your feet. Be easy with me, and I will destroy you. Who am I? I am habit. Men make the habits, habits make the men. What is a habit? It is a cable we weave, and we weave a thread of it every day until last, at least appears, that it cannot be broken. The concept of habit is biblical, and the reason I introduce it here is because the key to compatibility is to learn the habits that please your spouse and to get rid of habits that displease your spouse. And then when you start interacting with one another in a way that illustrates how you meet each other's need, because you develop those habits, then all of a sudden you're just naturally compatible. my wife Gail is really special, but we're not naturally compatible. We're very happily married. And sometimes people will say, oh, you and Gail have something special. You're just so lucky. And we'll look at each other and we'll say, luck has nothing to do with this. And we started off with a really rocky marriage in many ways. But we have prayerfully worked on things so that we understand each other and we treat each other in ways that please each other. And that's why we're happily married. It has nothing to do with luck. It has everything to do with being committed to our vows and to God and to loving each other. And any couple can do that. Bible says, exercise, discipline yourself unto godliness. In Proverbs 16, verse 3, commit thy works in Jehovah, and thy purposes will be established. Again, Solomon, make level the paths of thy feet, and all thy ways will be established. When it comes to being happily married, developing the right habits on a daily basis is the key. I'm not saying it's easy to change habits. They're hard to change. But it is worth taking the time to do so. What's the key? Well, you communicate clearly what your needs are and what offends you without defensiveness. And you really listen to what your spouse has to say and just be determined to develop new, better habits to improve your marriage. Because that's what the golden rule says you want your spouse to do for you, right? So you do that for them. Set the example. And focus on the love bank and your spouse's needs instead of just reacting, oftentimes defensively. Now, this is what happens to a couple when they start this process. Learn to habitually meet each other's needs. There's four stages. I find this fascinating. The first stage is you're unconsciously incompetent when it comes to meeting your spouse's needs. When I was first married, my wife says I was kind of obtuse. I'm sure she's correct about that assumption. But I thought that what I needed to do was to, you know, love my wife like I saw my father love my mother. The problem is my wife is a unique woman. She's not exactly like her mom. Some ways that worked, some ways it didn't. But I didn't know any better. And so I would wake up every morning not realizing it and do some things that were offensive and miss opportunities to make deposits. I was unconsciously incompetent, though I meant well. And it wasn't until we'd been married about 7 years that we really started some deep communication that opened my eyes to a lot of things. And once she expressed some things a lot better, and I became aware of some things she didn't like that I was doing that she hadn't told me about. Now I became consciously incompetent because you tend to continue your old patterns, right? Only now at least it began to prick my conscience a little bit. Oh, wait a minute. She doesn't like me doing that. And so you go from being unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. And then hopefully you catch yourself. And you start changing your behavior and you're working on your habits. And now you become consciously competent because you're working on it. You're changing and you're thinking about it. And it's consciously trying to do better. And then over time, in about 8 weeks, you start developing new habits. And now you're unconsciously competent. And that's a wonderful thing to be in. Now you're compatible and literally irresistible to each other. It's worth the work. And the blessings are immense. Okay, we're going to talk in our worship period about love busters. And rather than introducing love busters, we're out of time. The bell just rang. Let's just go ahead and stop here. I think I've done what I wanted to in this first session, is introduce these concepts so that we can really grasp more fully what really does make a marriage work. And there is a handout called The Love Bank that I encourage every couple to put on the refrigerator as a reminder as you begin to apply these messages. Okay, looks like folks are starting to come in. So much for Q&A, right? But keep your questions handy, because I want to end up tonight with whatever questions you have about anything we've said as we process this material together. So thank you for being here, and I look forward to kind of unraveling these things in the next two lessons. God bless you.